Good afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Coop and welcome to the Spoken Metal Show. Right off the bat, I just want to say thank you to all those that attended the Spoken Metal Show live, the first Spoken Metal Show live that we've ever held out. I was ever kind of put together. It was a dream to do this over the last maybe 2 or 3 years, just to put it out there and get it done. And it was one of those ones, scary, but a whole lot of fun. A lot of people enjoyed it. It's a great turnout, and I think we're going to be doing more and more of those again because, you know, they were fun. I had those music guys on, and they were just, I can't tell you how amazing they were. Funny, interesting, and we'll definitely get them on again. Their podcast is definitely something you should check out. Christopher Brown as well, UK music solicitor, and, you know, amazing stuff, just really interesting things, funny. And he's one of us. He's one of the good guys. And it was just wonderful to get some real interesting insights. And we only just scratched the surface on that. The format of it is pretty solid as well. I think everybody enjoyed it and it worked really well. So we're going to do a lot more of them. I enjoyed the hell out of them. They were fucking brilliant. Big shout out to Ian and the Outpost for helping together. And of course, obviously my cohort Mark for really kind of threading the needle and getting it done for me at the show. Really appreciate that, brother. There are going to be lots more. The next show is going to be February the 10th, which is going to be the Spoken Metal Show Sessions, which is a different thing again, where we have bands, but it's more like Jules Holland with metal, if you will, where I'll be interviewing and introducing them. And it's a curated group of bands. It's not bands that are necessarily broke through or big on the scene. It's new bands and interesting bands, and bands that I enjoy that you may not have heard of before. You're going to see and hear some new songs by bands you've never really checked out before, and I think they're pretty fucking good, so I'd like you to check them out. And so those things will happen, and it will come to pass after February. February's a fucking massive, massive month for metal. We've got all kinds of things going on. We've got Conan playing, Malevolence are playing. There's a ton of great gigs as well. So much metal going on. I'm going to do some more preview shows kind of in getting preparation for that, and as we get closer to that. But I just want to say thank you again for those that came out to the Spoken Metal Show live. There will be more, and we'll try in different venues and different things. But it was really enjoyable. It's great to get that immediate feedback that people laugh when you say something, or people, you get that silence as people are listening to what you're saying. People afterwards, you know, get something from it, which is always the biggest prize of all for me, that someone gets something from it and enjoys it. And that's incredibly important for me. So I'm really glad you did, and I'm looking forward to the next one and the sessions that are coming thereafter. I've got some shows in the can now that I've been recording, some that I'm going to put close to Christmas so we give a present to everybody. This show coming up now is with David Ross and David Ross Musical Instruments. I so wanted to do this show because I want to speak to people who do behind the scenes work, who are just, you know, hear about these people. They're not famous per se, you know, but they make the instruments and the effects, in this case, of which, you know, people use to make the beautiful music we listen to. And it was just fascinating to talk to David. He's kind of a one-man thing. He does all his own promotion, all his own videos and stuff for his gear. The work he's doing with pedals is absolutely superb. He's producing really high-quality, high-end, really bespoke pedals that just sound fucking amazing. He plays too. He's a guitar player. And when you see on his demos, you see him playing, and he's based in the States, and he's just producing some fantastic work. And it was interesting to get into kind of where he's coming from, because these pedals take a long time to produce, and an incredible amount of thought goes into them, into the production of them, and the design, and the experimentation to get it to do the things that he wants to do. And it's just so interesting to see his perspective and how he got into it. I think this is one you're really going to enjoy. I've yet to speak to guitar sort of repairers and luthers and people who make musical instruments and pedals. So it was great to speak to David. But if you are someone who is in that field, I'd like to talk to you as well. I find it absolutely fascinating. This show will now come out pretty much the same time as he launches his Kickstarter for a submersion pedal that's coming out, which he very generously showed me the kind of the finished model on the show. And we talked a little bit about that. And that's a fucking great pedal for you guitarists out there. And I know a lot of guitarists listen to the show. You owe it to yourself to check out David Ross's work, and the pedals that he's previously done. Winter Storm is an incredibly and insanely amazing pedal. I'm a huge pedal geek, so we spent a whole bunch of time geeking over that. But also, you know, the whole process of creating something like that, and where does it start? How do you go about it? How do you fund and produce it independently, you know, because it's just him and the musical instruments he does and his little studio that he has. And how does that happen? And these are the people that are a part of the ecosystem that makes up the music scene. These are they're just as important, you know. The people that invented certain pedals give certain sounds which help certain songs come together, and we get into this. And without them, that doesn't happen. So these people are just as important as a promoter is or a sound guy is to the business of what we do in music. And you know, we're all, you know, anybody who plays any kind of instrument is always looking for that pedal that does something just slightly out of the ordinary, or that no one kind of thinks about, or no one kind of predicted. And everybody's looking for those bespoke pedals that the not the bigger, that kind of sound that's only your own. It's almost an endless search. They call it GAS, like a gear acquisition syndrome. And we're always looking for that. But it's what other people are that are behind it that help make this. And just some of the videos that I've been watching on his YouTube channel, and Ross goes through the work that this gentleman puts into it, and the thought. And when he goes, that didn't work, this doesn't work, let's try this. This isn't just a pedal that's just thrown together. This is made with care, attention by someone who, you know, understands what he wants to get out of the pedal and understands what he wants to get out of the effect, and understands the music as well, particularly sort of the more extreme music. Winter Storm, he does some great demos for, like, you know, black metal on there that's definitely worth checking out. He's launched the Kickstarter now for that pedal. I strongly recommend you get involved with that, because there's only a handful of these pedals out there, and the submission pedal it's another dynamic as well. So I would also check out his earlier pedals as well. I don't think he's made one that's bad in any way, shape or form. I think they're all incredibly usable as well. They're not in kind of, like, you know, totally niche. They're very, very usable pedals. And I would suggest any of my guitar friends that are listening to the show really owe it to yourself to get one of those on your board, because I think it's going to really, really change your sound in a very, very positive way. But it was nice to sit down with David and go through, how does that happen? Where does it start? Where did he start? And so we're going to have a really nice chat about things going forward. I think we're going to do a little bit more when he's out, because I just find the whole process fascinating, from inception to delivery to on your pedal board to ultimately, let's face it, writing a song and that pedal or that effect becomes part of that song. That's a beautiful sort of circle of life for that. And we get into it, because I didn't know anything about the things about pedal manufacturing and the circuitry and stuff that goes on to it. I'm pretty sure there's people listening now that didn't know that. And David, is one of the beautiful things that he does is he's very open and explains kind of, this worked, this didn't work, this is how I felt about this. Really open. And if you check out some of his Instas as well, just loves what he's doing, and that's very infectious. That I came away from this show talking to David and completely reset my pedal board, ready for some of his pedals probably. I completely looked at how I was doing things electronically, just because I felt influenced by that, you know, influenced by his passion. It came across, and I hope it comes across to you, the listener. So please, you know, please feel free to check out Dave Ross Musical Instruments on Instagram. I'll put a whole bunch of links, as I always do, but please enjoy my conversation with David Ross about all things pedals and effects. Ladies and gentlemen, it's really nice to sit down with David Ross. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome, sir. I've been waiting to do a show like this for some time and speak to someone in your trade for quite some time, because it gives us a chance to nerd out about musical instruments and electronic equipment and pedals and what have you. But also anybody listening that's into the metal, you know, David also loves his metal, so there'll be some of that too. So yeah, thanks for coming on the show. Really, really appreciate it, my friend.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
And normally I start with the first music that you hear, but I think because of what you do, I think let's talk about the first sort of musical instruments you lay your hands on and the first experiences with that. What's that like for you?
Sure. Well, my father was actually a music teacher. He's now retired, but he taught music lessons for many years in addition to being a performer. So music was always kind of around. I think the first musical instrument I ever played was actually piano, or maybe even recorder. I played recorder in school for many years, but it was probably piano. It's actually I played piano, but I never really connected with it. That's kind of like the theme with me for probably up until my early teens, when I discovered guitar. I played like a lot of instruments, but I wasn't really passionate about any particular one up until the point when I started playing guitar.
Was that introduced to you by someone, or did you have a school setting where they had many instruments and you picked it up from there?
My parents actually bought me like a $100 Strat copy, and like
Sure.
basically as a gift, and said like, here you go. Like, my father basically told me like, I'll teach you how to play this. And so like at first I wasn't really that enthusiastic about it. Like I was, happy that they gave me the gift, but up until that point I hadn't really connected with anything musical. But it was actually when I realized that I could play music that I was personally interested in that it really clicked for me, and that's when it really jumped off. Actually, the since it is a metal podcast, the first song that I learned how to play that I wanted to learn was actually "For Whom the Bell Tolls" by Metallica,
Oh
and
yeah, sure.
it's a very simple song, but it's like something that really allowed me to, kind of get my foot in the door as far as playing guitar. And also at that point, like around 13 or so, I was like very early starting to get into metal. So
It could have gone all differently, couldn't it, David? If Cliff Burton had picked up the recorder,
that's true, yeah.
it could have all been different. But it's interesting that you say that the first sort of musical instruments are piano and recorder. Recorder is like we have that in the UK as well. It's almost like the de facto instrument that you give to a young person because it's so cheap and it's probably the most cheapest thing maybe to a drum, I suppose, that's so easily accessible. But it's hard to make the recorder cool, isn't it? It's hard to it's not a very it's not the instrument of rebellion, is it? Let's be honest. And the piano, well, that always seemed to me, we had a piano when I was learning music, it always seemed too complicated. It seemed like there was lots of things going on, lots of keys. They weren't all spaced the same and different things. And I couldn't really get into it. And it was always kind of rooted in classical music, which now I know is very cool, but at the time wasn't very cool to me. So then you get the guitar and then you find Ride the Lightning and then you're listening to it and you just want to create the sounds that you hear as quickly as possible. And the guitar facilitates that. That's why I believe, it's probably one of the most accessible and first instruments of many, many people in the world, all across the world, because it's so quick to make to from learning something to making that noise, isn't it?
that's true. The thing with recorder and also piano, like you said, it is very classically based, and like now I can appreciate it. But when you're 10 or 12 or 13, like at that point I was kind of listening to, like pop punk, like Green Day and Sum 41 and bands like that. And like that was really like the furthest thing away from recorder or piano. Like it really just it doesn't have a lot of relation to young people. And so guitar is definitely something that's it's more a scene. It's like more it's just more familiar.
There's an immediacy to it as well, isn't there? There's like, especially when you add distortion into that, you play through a distorted amp or a distorted distortion pedal, there's that re you're very quickly or in your mind very quickly sounding like the people that you are idolizing. I remember discovering something as simple as palm muting. The very first time I cracked palm muting, I was like, well, this is it. I'm clearly James Hetfield. I'm clearly like,
Right.
and it was these little breakthroughs that are now very simple. But I think that that's one of the things that that why I consider myself a guitar player. That I it's because that was my first real love. And then what was interesting for me with guitar is that it opened up a whole thing of like classical guitar, nylon strung guitars, and Spanish guitar and stuff. And I kind of went down a couple of those routes. So you had this sort of cheap Stratocaster knockoff, or I had a Les Paul knockoff. You know, they were kind of my entry level price ones. And were you at this point just playing for yourself, or were you playing in bands or that type of situation?
At this point, I was pretty much just playing for myself. I would say that I also, my father also had a blues band, and I would play in that.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, at this point, I would say I was pretty much just playing for myself. And once I really kind of got that launching point, that was really it. Like I really devoted a tremendous amount of time to learning how to play. And it's actually funny, like when I was probably 15 or 16, I got really into Children of Bodom because...
Oh, yeah, Alexa, yeah.
Yeah, it was like I was really fascinated with both like heavy music and also melodic music, and Children of Bodom was like the perfect combination of both.
Yeah.
And you know, they had like the neoclassical influence, like very Yngwie Malmsteen influenced. And so like they basically made like classical music like sound really great and like really cool and modern. And from there, like I wanted to play like Alexi so bad. Like he was like my guitar hero. Like,
great player. Great player. I was like, it was people like Malmsteen and Alexi and stuff that really kind of took like the Phrygian stuff that was going on with classical music and brought it into metal. That was happening. You heard that in some of the intervals that were going on in metal, and it really kind of broke out. And then it had, like you say, that revival with Children of Bodom and a lot of those sort of bands that were deeply technical but also super heavy as well, and it made it this really new sound. It seems like every so often, what was it Zappa used to say, the modern virtuoso refuses to die. That, you know, yes, we love the whole kind of stripped down Nirvana thing where it's just, you know, three chords and the truth, but every so often we love virtuosity. And when it's put in place, and you know, Alexi did a great job of that, sounding cool, great riffs, but also having this really kind of, you know, like classical runs style sound. I mean, for me, that was always the first time I heard that was obviously Randy. You know, Randy Rhodes was those kind of descending classical licks and stuff, and he was bringing a whole bunch of stuff into that, which I'd never heard before. Was it a person or particular guitar player? Was it just Alexi, or was it kind of Hetfield as well? Who were your guys when you were kind of learning this stuff then?
I would say Alexi was probably like, he was probably the biggest one at that age. Also, like through him, I learned about Yngwie Malmsteen. And then like one of Alexi's influences was Zakk Wylde, who I was kind of like, I was already somewhat familiar with because like early on, you know, like you're not super deep into metal. And so like, you kind of just, you know who you know. And like Black Sabbath, Ozzy Osbourne was very prominent, Metallica, like bands like that. And so I would say like Zakk Wylde, also very much an influence, because with him he was also like he would play metal with Ozzy, but he was also like a really tremendous blues player, which I found interesting because you know, I was playing in my father's blues band at this point and kind of learning blues on guitar. And so like seeing how he incorporated blues into metal was very interesting. And kind of later on, I realized that blues is really the fundamental of rock, which is really the fundamental of metal. And so it really translates well throughout the genres.
Yeah, it was a conscious decision, wasn't it? Zakk Wylde talks about that when he went in for the gig, that, you know, he didn't want to sound like Randy Rhoads or J.K. Lee for that matter. And he didn't want to do all the stuff that the kind of late 80s shredders were doing. So that kind of stuff was out, like tapping and stuff was relatively out. And he was like, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll do the faster pentatonic stuff. I'll bring in harmonics. There was some chicken picking in there and banjo rolls and things like that. And you know, there was lots of Frank Gambale stuff and Mahogany Rush in there. There was a whole melting pot, and he kind of went off and did his own thing. Now he plays, obviously, you know, Rhodes' stuff when they play it live, but he brought his whole style in, which was, by his own admission, totally blues-based, because that was, at the time, was very anti that kind of Guitar Hero stuff, you know, that almost Steve Vai Satriani stuff. He was doing a more, like you say, a more practical blues thing. And that's, right. And it was weird that created a schism, and he went off and did so, you know, some of the best stuff Ozzy did was with Zach. You know, arguably he's the second best guitarist that Ozzy ever had. You know, it's difficult to put him in order, but he certainly brought a whole new thing. I think because, you know, Ozzy was at the time, you know, is a songwriter. And, you know, and if you, for want of a better way of seeing it, the blues was a lot of it. It's not so much his favourite stuff, but the Beatles was his favourite stuff. And it was all based in the same world. So you could see how, like, you know, you get to, you know, Mama, I'm Coming Home and No More Tears and that type of stuff. Those are all bluesy-based songs. They are a hell of a bluesy-based song. So it's interesting that's how he stood out. Now we're seeing a switch, aren't we, where virtuosity is taking a bit more of a front seat now, where, you know, bands like Animals as Leaders and Toshin and, you know, Polyphia, they're unabashedly going, look, this is this interesting stuff out, and they're mixing techniques. And it seems like the virtuoso is coming back. It's becoming popular again.
Right, right. Yeah, it is interesting to see that switch. Also, another kind of blues-based guitar player was Dimebag Darrell, who was like very closely related to Zakk Wylde. Yeah. And it's interesting because like blues is very feel-based. It's very emotive. And just like Dimebag Darrell's solos, like, I mean, there's some speed in there, but there's also some like really just, you know, very blues-based, like emotional type of solos. And it's incredibly effective.
Well, it's like I was, you know, specifically when I was starting, I spent a lot of time practicing vibrato because of the blues side of what I listen to. And it's always been, I think, even amongst technical or non-technical players, the vibrato is always the dead giveaway, I think, to a style of someone. I can hear Dimebag's vibrato and tell you instantly it's his. I can hear Eddie's and here is, but I can hear Toshin's and Vi's. I can hear all them. And Brian May, I can tell you who it is, like 6 seconds, and I know who it is. And it's always been a good telltale sign that, you know, if you haven't got that, if you haven't got that feel, then you really, you know, everything else kind of falls by the wayside. You know what I mean? All of the players that we talked about can shred and can play fast, but they can also completely groove. In fact, most of their most memorable riffs are quite slow. You know, they're not intensely technical. And I think that's the other thing that comes up when we talk about guitar playing, is that there seems to be a couple of camps. And one of the camps is, you must know as much as you can know. It's like your voracious appetite for all your get all your sort of skills and styles down. Know your fretboard front to back. Know everything. Know all your modes. Know all your scales. All this knowledge versus people who are like, no, you don't need any of that, and you should just play what you feel is right. Where are you on that? Where do you kind of stand?
I suppose I'm in more of the latter camp. I mean, my father being a guitar teacher, he obviously knows like all the scales, all the modes, all of that. Yeah. Me personally, I never really connected with music in that way. I would definitely say it's worth knowing. Like, there's nothing wrong with knowing it, and you probably should. But for me, it never seemed like it was important enough to really put at the forefront. Like, I just kind of enjoy playing more than I enjoy, you know, learning about scales. I mean, I do certainly know some, and, you know, I know a fair amount of music theory, but I definitely am someone who is more in the, I suppose, like emotional type of guitar playing as opposed to more technical.
Yeah. I remember reading once, it was a Guitar World magazine, and I had a transcription of Dead Skin Mask by Slayer. And in the beginning, it used to have a little column, and the column would kind of break down what scales they were using, what kind of chord progressions they were using, all this type of thing. And it would give you a little insight to each song. But for Dead Skin Mask, because it was clearly wrote by Kerry or Jeff, and those notes at the beginning didn't follow any particular scale because it was played purely from feel. And the writer put that it doesn't really follow any particular pattern. And that's always rang in my ears a little bit. It was like, you know what, that's really cool and doesn't follow any rules. I think for me, theory's always been a useful thing if my creative juices dry up. If I don't know which way I'm meant to go, what's the next chord and which way should I go with this? You know, theory's nice to go, okay, it's in this key, so these are maybe some options, and then I'm off again. It's just, it's never been a fuel. It's always been just a top-up for ideas. You know, I've never really kind of leaned into it, although I consider myself quite well theory-based. It's never been the starting point. It's just been a little push. And once the car's moving, I kind of go, okay, let's just go with feel and play it that way. I've always been more involved in kind of style, in a feel. That's always been a big thing. All my favourite players have been that way. So you're playing with your dad's band and you're playing covers at this point then, around this time when you started to kind of really lean into the guitar, you're still playing covers with your dad?
I would say it's mostly covers and also some original work, original Wu songs. But yeah, like that, it really kind of gave me the basis of kind of what I could apply to other forms of music that I was also interested in, mainly being metal. I just found it, like, especially later on, like, just very helpful. Just a really fundamental
way. Were you and your dad playing in the band at the same time?
Well, we would play together. Like, I would play with, I would play in his band. And, just basically, like, from early on, I think maybe I was playing, like, for 2 years, and then I started playing with him. And then this kind of progressed over time. And it's been neat kind of seeing how I've progressed as a blues player also, in addition to just, you know, a guitar player in general. Like I've certainly gotten better at playing the blues. Like it's something that's very difficult to master, but like easy to learn.
That must be a cool thing to be able to do, to be able to jam with your dad. You know, that must be, that's a very cool, on those first shows, did you just sit back and play rhythm, or did you break out and did you harmonize? Did you trade off?
First shows, I was pretty much just playing rhythm, just kind of, you know, like getting on stage and like actually being on stage. Right?
Past,
that was the experience. But then over time, I was kind of getting more and more comfortable playing leads. And so, you know, I'd go from like, if we like played a set, I'd have maybe one lead. And then, you know, over time, I was playing one on pretty much every song. And going from going from like 12 bars to 24.
Yeah.
Basically just kind of working my way up.
That's ace. I love that. That's like what a wonderful bonding experience that must be to, you know, to play with you. You know, because as we all know, you know, it's a combat music, especially with a group of musicians, is a conversation. You know, no one's actually talking, but you are connecting through the music. You know, that's a wonderful thing. That's amazing. You know, does your dad have any interest in metal? Does he, or he's just like, no, it's not for me.
He can appreciate the musicianship of it, but he doesn't really. I've never known him to listen to it. I've shown him people, like I've shown him Zakk Wylde and you know, Dimebag Darrell and stuff like that, and he likes it. I mean, he appreciates the musicianship, but like he would never like listen, like
who's
sit down and listen to Black
guys?
Sabbath.
Who's his players?
I would say like classic blues players, definitely. You know, the Three Kings, BB, Freddie.
Yeah.
Alberts. Like very much blues based. Also like avant-garde jazz, Coltrane.
Yeah.
I would say with him, it was kind of there was kind of a duality with him between blues and jazz, and with me, it's kind of blues and metal. So it's a little bit interesting like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was probably, you know, for both of you, it was probably formed fairly early on where you took those, you know, those disciplines and you went that way. He went the blues and the jazz route, you went the blues and the metal route because of, you know, what was around you and what you were listening to. You know, for him, Coltrane would have been massive when he was growing up. You would have been, you know, that would have been everywhere. You know, Davis and stuff like that would have been, and jazz was massive. You know, was booming. For you, it's metal. That's interesting. And you know, and the commonality is blues. You know, did you then form your own bands then, or what happened then?
I never really formed my own band. I always kind of preferred Just playing on my own, learning on my own and doing my own thing when it comes to like playing actual music. But probably around like 17 or so, that's kind of when I got into the whole guitar repair thing. And that really kind of like that was kind of the main focus for me as opposed to like playing live music. I really kind of enjoyed the guitar repair type of thing. And
How did that start then? Was it something go wrong with your guitar or seeing something else? What happened?
yeah, basically, the $100 guitar that I was playing it for like 3 or 4 years, and something went wrong with it. I got it repaired, and it came back, and it played like much better than it did when I started. And I was really fascinated with how that could happen. And also around this time, I just like, you just kind of look at a guitar and you kind of have to work on it in order to, keep it up. And so, I guess one day I was just like taking it apart, and I think I just took every piece of it apart and tried to put it back together. And like just like having it all in pieces, it made me kind of realize that like it doesn't really go together in any like complicated way. Like it's all pretty logical and straightforward. It was only later that I realized I was wrong and it actually is really complicated. I could kind of see what they were doing when they made it. And yeah, that was very fascinating to me because I got in my head that I could probably make one myself. And I
So
eventually kind of got into the whole building thing.
did you start going, okay, I think I can make a guitar myself, or did you start a little bit earlier than that, in so much as you were going, okay, let me figure out what they mean by intonation and setups and the electronics? Was that what you kind of pulled it apart for? You were like, what's inside here? How does this work? Or did you just go straight to, let's build a guitar and reverse engineer it from there?
I suppose it was kind of both. Like when I took it apart, I basically wanted to see like I just wanted to see it in pieces, I suppose. And and then like it was kind of a natural progression. Like I knew I wanted to build one. And so I was learning about all of this stuff, like setting it up, intonation.
We was this through the internet then at this point? Was it pretty capable? Yeah, so you could go and there was a resource, so you could go and look at things and kind of see circuit diagrams and videos of things, yeah.
Yeah, this was like 2007 or 2008, and so YouTube was like kind of coming into its own, and so I could see like people building guitars on YouTube, and also around this time there was like a guitar forums, like there was the Project Guitar Forum, there was Ultimate Guitar, and they had sections for like building and repairing guitars. And so I would just like scour these sites and just learn as much as I could. And at this time, like people were posting pictures of guitars that they were in process of building. And I just found it like endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, it's something. That's why, ladies and gentlemen, that's why I've been eager to get David on the show, because there's a wonderful mysticism to guitar building and repair. Yes, you can read in a book how to refret something, or how to adjust the truss rod, but so much of it is based on feel and what you have in front of you and how the wood is and reacting to stuff. And it's a wonderful art. Did you then use that $100 guitar to kind of practice on it first? Did you go, okay, what does the truss rod do, and how does the bridge set up? Did you do that first and kind of tinker with that to get it to play and how you liked it?
I did, yeah. That guitar basically became a sacrificial lamb, basically out of necessity because, around that time I didn't have a ton of money, and so if I wanted to get into this, like, I learned about changing the pickups with it. I actually scalloped the fretboard. Speaking of Yngwie Malmsteen earlier, I saw that he did it, and I gave it a shot online just because, it was something to do. And but yeah, it was basically like just learning different mods on that particular guitar. It was definitely kind of necessary to do in order to progress in terms of building and repairing.
I wonder how many, you know, because you talk about, you know, Project One and this Stratocaster, the $100 Project One, before you kind of obviously moved on to other things. But some of all, you know, the greatest sort of players I find have an affinity with kind of destroying and recreating their stuff. Eddie very famously, but then Les Paul, you know, would take stuff apart and rebuild it how he wanted it to be. And you, I wonder how many guitars we got through with someone like Eddie before we got to the Frankenstrat. You know, how many did sacrifice to get that? You know, because it was a different neck, it was a different body pickup. Everything was scoured from. The whole thing was exactly like the name suggests, a complete Frankenstein project, you know. And I've often thought that, you know, that's the kind of the missing link to becoming a great guitar player is understanding the instruments as well. You know, scalloping the neck of the neck of a guitar has an obvious immediate effect on playing and vibrato and everything based on that. And I've often thought that it was the real secret to getting, you know, we talk about getting the sound in your fingers, but it really does help if the machine you're working with, the tool you're working with, is really custom to your degree. So when did you move on from the $100 guitar? Did you make it? Did you go straight to making a new one, or did you get another guitar and modify that?
I would say it was probably I went down both paths. Just kind of continue modding guitars that I owned, and also at this point, getting into building. I pretty much knew that, like, I had the idea that I wanted to build guitars professionally. And kind of part of that is being able to repair them, modify them, do all that type of work. Basically what I'm doing now is pretty much just exclusively doing repairs, and also doing the guitar pedal thing, which we can talk about later.
Absolutely.
Guitar building, like, the thing about it is, like, there is a ton of knowledge that you need to have, and there's also a ton of equipment. And over time, I accumulated a lot of the knowledge and a lot of the tools. But building guitars, I mean, you need so much. Like, you need so much space and so much equipment. And, you know, basically, if I were to build a guitar right now, I would probably need about $1,000 in parts. And it becomes a financial thing where, if, like, does it make sense to spend $1,000 on parts and probably, you know, $1,500 in labor? You have $2,500 in it total. Is it going to sell for that? Like, if it's not perfect, then it won't. And it's extremely difficult to make it perfect. But
because we're in a time now where you know, the quality of guitars, I don't know if you would agree with this, the quality of guitars now is significantly higher, probably the highest it's ever been.
Definitely.
Like, sort of 20 years ago, you know, so the level of quality that was leaving the shop maybe wasn't that great. You know, now there's some things like, you know, shielding and stuff that is now almost like, you know, the baseline of an item. You know, it gets things like this, and, you know, and it's probably like, now, you know, your entry level guitar now is like something that maybe someone famous would play 20, 30 years ago. That the quality of everything has moved up. Would you agree? Is that fair, do you think?
I would definitely agree. Yeah, I mean, if you look at examples of, like, electric guitars coming out of Japan in the 1960s, I mean, they're a complete mess. Like, those guitars are, I mean, they're playable, but they're really unpleasant to play. Now, I mean, guitars, you know, $100, I mean, you can play a gig with them. Like, there's plenty that's wrong with them. Like, they're not, there's a reason why they're $100, but they're still, like, compared to what it once was, I mean, it's weeks ahead.
And mainly because, like, you know, you can make, because I suppose it's tiered guitar sort of repair. You have maintenance, repair, and modification. So you have, like, you know, there's the maintenance of it. Well, that's just changing the strings and, you know, oiling the neck and things like that. And, you know, WD-40 and connections and contact cleaner. And these things are you know, something that maybe a non-guitar player doesn't realize are absolute the stock and trade of a guitar tech and a guitar manufacturer. But then you have repair, which is like, you know, sorting out, you know, fret buzz and things like that, and stuff like that, and, you know, working with, you know, the saddle or the Floyd Rose and repairing parts of that and setting that up and intonation and all things we talk about. And then modification. Okay, I want to take out the pickups. I want to change this. I want to refret this. I want to, like, sculpt the neck, for example. And it's tiered, isn't it? And so I think most people's first sort of, things kind of like where they look at modifying a guitar or even repairing is the strings, you know, and kind of changing that. And what's interesting about all these different things that we're going to talk about have massive rabbit holes you can fall down from, just something as simple as strings and how they're threaded through, how you even tie them off and cut them if you don't cut them, and all this sort of thing, have all these massive permutations. So what I suppose I'm leading to here is, when did you go from making an altering guitars for yourself, but then doing it for other people?
I started doing it for other people. I would say, well, I started my business officially in 2021. So I was at it for maybe even longer than I should have, but like I could have started my business sooner, but I had been at it for about 15 years. And the reason for this is I wanted to feel 100% confident that if a customer brings me a guitar, I know what I'm doing. And like, I know what I don't know, basically. Like, that's a big thing that I learned over time is, you know, like, you get at a certain point and you think like, okay, I understand theoretically what to do here, but there's the theoretical part of guitar repair, and then there's the application of it. And those are two very different things. Like, for example, leveling the frets on a guitar, you can read about that all day, but I guarantee the first time you do it, it's going to be a disaster, because the thing about guitar repair is you have to crack eggs. Like, you have to, you have to just get into it, get dirty, get your hands dirty and make mistakes. Like, I've said it many times that I've like butchered some of my guitars just because, you know, I thought I knew what I was doing, only to find out that I didn't. And, but that's just part of the process. I mean, it's one thing to read about something, but it's another thing to actually do it. Yeah. And yeah, so I was probably 15 years in before I started actively taking on customers' guitars. And there's still things that I won't do, like, for a customer, just because if I think it's over my head, or if I think that I can't do it the way that it needs to get done, that's actually something that I see somewhat often from other guitar repair shops is, I mean, they'll take on work and they really shouldn't be, because, you know, they don't know enough to say no. And that's definitely part of it. I think, like, the mark of a good luthier is to look at something and say, like, I shouldn't do this.
Like, it's knowing when you're out of your depth, or you're just inexperienced, or it's like, you know, often I find with the luthiers that I've known and the great guitar techs that I've worked with is that, you know, sometimes, you know, knowing when it's not your bag and it's not your thing. Like, I know people who were great with necks, who were not great body guys. You know, I know people that are wonders with electronics, but have, you know, no idea how a saddle or Floyd Rose even works. You know, it's and because they've had to specialize in various parts of the instrument. Some people only work on acoustic guitars. Some only work on classical. You know, some, you know, there's many, many sort of disciplines. And so it's interesting you say, you know, even after 15 years, it's an extraordinary amount of time to be serving your apprenticeship, shall we say, you're still able to say, you know what, this is my wheelhouse and I know what I'm doing here, so this is what I'm going to do. When do you think, if you're a guitar player, because this leads to this question, is when should you take it to a professional and when should you try and do it yourself? Is there a level to that?
I would say it's never a bad idea to take it to a professional. regardless of what it is, even if it's for a setup. Like, I know that, like, people nowadays seem to think that, like, getting a setup from like a guitar repair man is a ripoff or whatever. I see this type of thing online, like, a lot. Like, people will say, well, I set up my own guitar. I set up guitars, like, I mean, hundreds. Like, there's a big difference between you setting up a guitar, once or twice a year, and me doing it, every day, all day. Like, it's just a whole different thing. Like, my perspective on guitars is a lot different from somebody who just plays them. Like, for example, like, my father plays guitar. He doesn't know the mechanics of it really at all, but he knows when it plays well and when it doesn't. And so I would say it's never a bad idea. Just take it to them, get their opinion. You might actually end up learning something that you didn't know, or you take it to them and you think, well, I was about to do this, and then you realize, like, oh geez, like, I'm glad I didn't, because I would have been in over my head. So it,
A good setup can make a terrible guitar sound amazing. It really can. And ladies and gentlemen, when we're talking for the uninitiated who maybe aren't into guitars, the setup is basically how the guitar is set up for the person playing it. And there's a number of factors that can come into it. There's no right total setup. Right for you might be wrong for me. Things like the height of the strings, ladies and gentlemen, for the non-guitar players, the height of the strings can depend on your playing style. It can affect the different sounds. For example, a lot of shred guitarists have a very low height of guitar strings. So once again, there's no right or wrong answer. But if you prefer a different way and prefer a sound different way, then it has to be set up for you. I think that's why guitar techs normally have this relationship with their players, because they understand what they want out of it, so set and therefore can set up the instrument for it. So I think that's why you see guitar techs often working with people for most of their careers. Look at like Grady Champion with Dimebag. This is a lifelong collaboration between a luthier and someone who's looking after his instruments and the artist. And Dimebag freely admitting that he doesn't know how to set up his own guitar, not in a bad way, but he hands it to Grady to go, okay, you know what I sound like. We've worked together this long now to help me produce that sound.
Right. It's also the type of thing where you can't expect a guitar player to know, like, what somebody like I know. I mean, it's a completely different thing. It really doesn't have much to do. It's like somebody who drives a race car versus somebody who, like, works on cars. Like, there shouldn't be any expectation that somebody who does that would know one or the other. But for me personally, like, I enjoy both. Like, I enjoy playing guitar. I enjoy, building and repairing them. And so I basically just find guitar in general to be fascinating.
I think it's a language thing, isn't it? Where that you and I both enjoy playing and can talk about playing in various forms, but because we've also done work with guitars at a fundamental level, we can bridge that gap as well. So you might have a couple of extra words in your vocabulary that a guitar player won't, but there'll be a meeting ground somewhere in the middle. You could say,
Right.
okay, if we did this, it'll sound a little bit more like this. And he'll say, and it's that collaborativeness that really interests me with guitar techs working with people. Have you ever thought about teching and going out and going on the road for doing some work?
I haven't. It's an interesting thought. It's just, I suppose it's never really been a consideration for me. Just because, I have my own shop here, I have my own business, and really the goal with me was to kind of get to this place to have my own business and kind of try and support myself and my own business ventures. So that's basically what
It's
I'm.
interesting. The thing that the touring techs do is it gives you time constraints and inventory constraints. So you'll have only so long to do a job and only so many bits and pieces to do it. And it just what I find it does is it it sharpens the skills quite quickly, not always in a good way. You know, it's like the difference between going from a shooting range to a war. You know, if you're not very good very quickly, you're going to get found out. But it's interesting. And I think, you know, we talk about kind of the relationship with guitar techs and the guitar players to the point where some of them will work their own pedals and work their own kind of like, you know, rack systems. Interestingly, just to the side, you also work with pedals and effects. When did that start? Did it start around the same time as the guitar playing, or was there a little bit of a gap and then you brought that type of bits and pieces in?
Well, I've been playing guitar for about 20 years. I've been building and repairing guitars for 15, and I've been making pedals for about 7 years at this point. The guitar pedals really kind of came about as a natural progression of guitar repair, particularly wiring guitars, because, you know, you're dealing with a lot of the same components, potentiometers, capacitors, resistors, and occasionally you'll be dealing with active circuitry, which has op amps and other types of components like this. And so, you know, it's all kind of guitar related. So I think how it started for me is, like, I was looking at kind of like simple guitar pedal circuits, like the fuzz face. And, you know, I could read the schematic and I could kind of see how it went together. And it was really just kind of that, like it was just kind of a natural extension of guitar wiring. And then I realized that in addition to doing guitar repair, I also wanted to have like my own products as, or in addition to having my own service. And so that's kind of how it came about as far as the guitar pedals are concerned.
Yeah. Did during the kind of the pandemic and COVID, was that actually, you know, was that easier for you because you could then hunker down and kind of really put some time into this? You know, did you kind of spend that time in the shop, so to speak? Do you have a shop? Is it a shop that you can walk into, or?
It's not a shop that you can walk into, but basically if somebody calls me, they make an appointment.
Right.
The shop is actually in my basement. I have a fairly large workspace down there. And yes. So it allows me to really do any guitar repair work or guitar pedal work.
Yeah.
But as far as the pandemic, I kind of started my business at the tail end of the pandemic, or like I got the pedal thing rolling at the tail end of the pandemic. And so I didn't really get the benefits of like the sales of guitar pedals through that period. But the COVID pandemic, it didn't really have much of an effect on me as a creative person. Like I usually am kind of a stay at home type of person anyways. I don't usually like go out and party or do, you know, whatever. I'm usually at home. I'm usually like either playing guitar or, you know, doing guitar repairs or listening to metal. You know, this
that's
type of
like
thing.
You know, that one of my favorite pictures is of Eddie Van Halen in his shop, and he's surrounded by cables and all kinds of paraphernalia and all bits and pieces and plugs, and he's got a big workbench and he's working on a guitar. And as much as I'm sure he partied and had that lifestyle, I'm telling you now, he looks the happiest there, working on that guitar, figuring it out, going, okay, what can I do now, and messing things around. And I'm telling you, he was his happiest there. I never met him. I never knew him, but I'm sure that that was his happy place when he was playing with his guitar. They did something with it, went, oh, what about this? And then sat and played it and went back and tinkered with it. I'm sure that was the happiest he was. So I could totally see you in that, in your kind of happy place there, building and doing that. What was the first pedal that you kind of made then, your own pedal?
It's a bit of a tricky question. Like the first pedal that I made was like a fuzz face clone. And it took me like a year and a half or 2 years, because I had this insane notion that I should make a fuzz face, but I should do it like point to point wiring, like an amplifier.
Okay.
And this was just like, I just couldn't get it. Like I burned out the germanium transistors. Like, I mean, it was a real struggle. And, eventually I got a breadboard and I put like the components in the breadboard and I followed an instruction online and I got it to work. And it was just like the light bulb just went out, or it went on, and I just realized like I could actually make it. But
You could do this, yeah, that this was something you could do. I mean, the fuzz face was like one of the first effects that most people would have heard. You know, Hendrix was kind of one of the first proponents of it, and then it kind of slowly made its way into British music. You know, that was one of the first effects. And this was at a time, you know, think about when they first use effects, was sometimes that song was built around that effect. You know, you think, you know, I'm trying to think of like good examples, but Hi Ho Silver Lining, you know, these are all songs that had particular effects in. You know, the war at the beginning of Voodoo Child and stuff was sometimes that was the first time people would hear a war certainly being used in that fashion. You know, and the first sort of distorted guitar, it's only recently, I think he got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Link Wray was using that kind of distortion with guitar. And sometimes the first time you hear an effect is the first time in that song you'll ever hear it. And it kind of ties the effect to that song. You know, think about what Brian May was doing with like Brighton Rock and things like that, when it was using delays. These were the first times people were using them. And then they became that song. And it's wonderful that an effects pedal can have that, like where it can go, hold on, this riff sounds this way, but when I put this effect pedal on, it goes into a whole other realm.
Right. Yeah, and with the fuzz face, I mean, I'm a huge Jimi Hendrix fan. I mean, such a great player, like so stylish. I mean, just phenomenal. And the fuzz face, like him just turning that on in front of like a cranked up Marshall amp, like it sounds insane. And yeah, like the fuzz face, like for me, that was my first guitar pedal build. And a deceptively difficult circuit, but I eventually got it. And then from there, I kind of like progressed in terms of just making like simple circuits. Like I would make like a simple gain pedal, like a simple boost, and then like slowly like I was adding like EQ and that type of thing. And then eventually I got to the point where I kind of put them all together and I created a guitar pedal called the Winter Storm, which is
I've seen that.
It's basically like a 3-in-1 boost, overdrive, and distortion. So it can do three of those things in one pedal. Like I like guitar pedals that aren't too complicated, that like don't have like, 100 different knobs on them. I like kind of like just maybe four knobs and a switch, or even less. And that's kind of what I gravitate towards as a player and also as a builder.
We're in this interesting sort of time now where we've had the rack-mounted gear, we've had that kind of fridges at the side of the stage. Then there was a move away from that, which was more pedal-based. And then we had people, you know, we had kind of Slash and Zach with fairly minimal pedal boards. Then we moved into digital and modeling and things like Kemper stuff and fractal effects. And there seems to be it goes sways back and forth, and every so often it sways. It always seems to sway back to pedals, and you know we had like things like Klon pedals suddenly booming again, and with eBay booming, we found that boutique pedals have suddenly become, you know, super popular. You know the so it's probably you probably entered into both the best time to be into pedals and the worst, because you know, everybody's looking for that next pedal, aren't they? The next one that gives them that sound that enables that song or that riff or whatever it may be. But also, there's not so much competition, but there is so much out there, isn't it, of guitar pedals now, because people are doing like what you're doing it at home. But I had a quick listen to some of the stuff that the Winter Storm was doing, and it was superb, my friend. It was
Well, thank
absolutely
you.
superb. I've seen a lot of those devices that do that. You know, and you know, and some of the stuff that yours is doing, it reminded me of the Archer pedal and the stuff going on there as well, and the OCD. There was, and it's a wonderful mix there. It's interesting to me that you can make a pedal and it sound like you've made it as well, if you know what I mean. You put your personality into that, which I think is a fantastic thing.
Yeah, it, I would say like being a guitar player for as long as I have, and also you know, guitar repairman, it really kind of informs some of my decisions when it comes to making guitar pedals. I want them to be like practical for, you know, guitar players, as opposed to being like too, you know, outside the box. But I think it's definitely something that, like, I'm not interested at this point in, you know, making clones of other pedals or doing what other people have done.
Yeah.
To me, like, if you're going to stand out, like, you have to do your own thing. And it doesn't really make sense to me to, you know, basically just copy what other people have done. But you are right. I mean, like, I would say that this is definitely the best time as a guitar player to be into guitar pedals, because there is so much out there. As a manufacturer, I mean, I don't really view it as a negative, but like, there certainly are more guitar pedal builders than ever. But you kind of have to do something to stand on your own.
Have you thought about kind of what the next pedals are going to be? Have you got interest in kind of which way you're going to go after this?
I do, yeah. I'm actually, probably by the time this comes out, I suppose I'll just announce it here. I'm going to be doing a Kickstarter for my third guitar pedal release. It's called the Submersion. Actually, we're doing video, so I'll see if I can show it to you here.
Wow. Oh, that's lovely. But, ladies and gentlemen, for those that can't see, this is a lovely blue pedal called the Submersion. And this is wonderful. What's that going to do? I'm just looking at what that is now. What's that going to do then? To see the volume and the balance, what is it?
It's actually, the controls are volume and surface.
Obviously, yeah.
Basically, what this does is it's a two-knob pedal. It's a clean boost and also a clean blendable octave up fuzz.
Oh, yes.
And so basically you can use it like just as a straight clean boost if you turn the volume all the way up, or you can use it as a octave up effect to where you just kind of blend it in as much or as little as you want.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have like a ton of videos over the course of the next month, basically covering everything that this can do. I already put out one video on my YouTube channel, and I think it has like 400 views already, which is crazy to me. Like,
yes.
My YouTube channel is like extremely small, and it just blows my mind that like that many people could have watched, you know.
It looks incredibly well made as well. You know, this is, ladies and gentlemen, you couldn't see that then, but it looks incredible. You'll see, I'll put a link to the videos, and you know, but it looks incredibly well made as well. You know, what a great time that you can do a Kickstarter with that. You know, that's fantastic that you can do that, because then you can gauge the interest, you know, because you might be, I'm almost certain you will be blown away by the interest that you'll get from that, where you're like, oh, this many people really enjoy this and really kind of like the look of this, you know. And I suppose you're going to get that wonderful thing where when someone buys this and plays it themselves, they'll make that their own, you know. Right. So some will take the octave fully wide and have that really fat sound and go that way, or some will play the clean boost and you'll get that wonderful moment where you'll see it in the wild, you know, where people go, I'm kind of trying this out and listen to what I've created. And that's got to be, I don't make pedals, but if I did, I'm sure that's the Shangri-La, right? To see someone making a YouTube video of your particular pedal and it sounding fucking great.
Yeah, you know? it's definitely a thrill. Because, you know, when I play these pedals, I play it in my own certain way. And then seeing what other people do with them, I mean, it's wild to see. It's actually my second Kickstarter. And you're right, like, gauging the interest. The good thing about Kickstarter is it allows people to say, like, okay, I actually want this thing and I'm willing to pay for it. As opposed to, like, if I were to just release it, like, people would say, like, oh, yeah, I want it. But then it's like, well, you know, I had to take my dog to the vet. And so, like, you know, this, it really allows, like, as many people as, like, I can show it to kind of put, you know, put their money down and say that they really want it. Yeah. And it's good for me as a manufacturer, because like, I, you know, I don't have to guess how many people are going to want this. I'll know exactly, and I'll build accordingly. So yeah, that's definitely a good thing about it.
Yeah, it's a really good. You're one of those manufacturers as well that everybody's looking for, because you're producing a pedal that no one else has got. You know, you're still in the minority. You're not a major distributor, so you're still a minority. And it used to be the case that, you know, when I went to get a Wah, I would have to just get a Morley Wah. That was all it was. Now there's so many out there. You're one of those people where the audience is actually looking for you, not the other way around, because everybody's trying to find that mythical pedal that sounds like no one else, and they can help them sound like even more like themselves. And I think that's wonderful. I think that people are going to seek you out. I'll put links on the show to the Kickstarter and to your shop as well. But it sounds like it's a really exciting time for you. You know, you're going to be able to get to see people buying your pedal and benefit from that. It is a business, but also, you know, get to see them play it and have that thing now where people can put a YouTube video up on it or TikTok or whatever it may be of them playing your thing. That must be incredibly rewarding, that.
It is, yeah. Like I said, that's really the best part about doing this, is seeing what other people can do with something that you made. It's a real thrill.
Excellent. Listen, we could and probably will at another point talk about guitars and effects for a lot longer, ladies and gentlemen. But what a treat it's been to speak to David, sir. Wonderful. I cannot endorse your work anymore. I will put some links within the show to check it out. I'm going to be joining the Kickstarter. I'm sure there'll be a lot of guitar players after hearing your videos will also be joining that as well, because we know something that no one else does, that David makes really good pedals. Don't tell too many people before we can have it in our pedal board setup. Sir, thanks for coming on the show. It's been wonderful.
Well, thank you. I very much appreciate it, and we'll definitely have to do it again.
Wonderful David Ross there from David Ross Musical Instruments. I really enjoyed that, and I hope you did too. It was interesting to do a little bit of a deeper dive on effects and kind of the whole thing of that industry. And a window into a world where he's kind of doing it on his own, which is just superb. It just shows you how much passion. You know, some of these things take 2-3 years to put together, which is incredible to me. The commitment, what he's doing, is absolutely superb. David Ross there, I'm going to put a whole bunch of links, as I always do, via social medias and put it out there. But you really need to check out what he's doing. Currently doing a Kickstarter for the Submersion pedal, which is just unbelievable. Watch some of the demos on that. Just like, that's a pedal board that needs to be in your pedal. That pedal board that needs to be on your hit list there. Just an incredible pedal and made by someone. You know, you can now put a face behind the pedal that designed it, and you can have your very own David Ross design pedal. There won't be very many, and it's still, you know, both good and bad that he's not massive yet. Good, because we can get in on now and find these pedals before everybody else gets them and the price goes through the roof. And bad, because, you know, he should be able to spend all of his time and have loads of money for doing this wonderful work he's doing for the music entire industry. As I say, these pedals shape sounds shape songs and lives, and David Ross is 100% doing it. Really nice to get him on the show. We'll probably do it every time he comes brings a pedal out. We'll get him on the show, because I thought it was fantastic. And I hope you enjoyed that too. Once again, thanks for coming to the Spoken Metal Show live that we did. Cannot thank you enough. Looking forward to the Spoken Metal Show sessions we do on the 10th of February. And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff coming that we're going to be shows for. Once again, thanks for listening. I'll see you at the show.